supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And saying, you know, I want a property that has a walk score of 95. You know, they're not doing that.
Ostroff said the ratings seem most helpful for out-of-state customers or people who use an online self-service site such as Zillow. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
In sports, the Union hold their season finale at PPL Park today as the Red Bulls head into town, the Tap at 1:30, college football, Temple's at Pittsburgh at noon, and it's Penn State versus Ohio State at 5:30. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of them thrill-packed shows for you this week, Cats and Kittens. In the question of the week, we're going to explain why all your impatience died this past summer. And we're also going to talk to author Richard Horan, who discovered just how hard picking can be when he participated in the harvest of 10 different crops across America. Now, that's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Nancy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Nance. How are you today?
Good. I'm doing good. How are you?
I am just fine, thank you. And where is Nancy Good?
I am in Chester County.
Pennsylvania.
Yes.
All right. What can we do for Nancy in beautiful Chester County?
Okay, the question I have is regarding winter window boxes. I have some wrought iron window boxes that are lined with coconut liners.
Oh.
Yeah, why is that not a good thing?
Well, you know, as you probably noticed, how long have you had these, Nance?
Well, actually, I just planted these things probably in around June during the summertime, and everything, you know, turned out really well, and they looked great, and I'm just wondering what to do now, you know, during the winter.
Did you notice that you had to water them several times a day?
Yes, they required a lot of water.
These things are so pretty, and they look so good, and I have them as well. I have big wrought iron stand-up things that are so old, I've had to start making the liners myself. I've had to buy that coconut fiber and roll and cut it. And I ain't no Martha Stewart. But one of the problems with these things is they are not insulated in any way. In the summertime, they wick their moisture into the air. Sometimes it seems in a matter of minutes. And in the wintertime, they don't offer much protection against the cold. So there's a couple of different options. First, one of the things I've done, because I have multiple things of these outside my house, I'll take out the coconut fiber liners for the winter time, and I'll put in like plastic window boxes or three or four round containers that just happen to fit in the wrought iron. And then I've got a better chance of keeping those plants alive. It's very difficult because, as you can imagine, that soil is going to freeze hard every time it gets even mildly cold outside, and it's hard to keep water in it, and sometimes the winter's dry. So they are less than ideal for outside planters. Now, if you had regular window boxes, some people, by the way, also line them with plastic. They'll go out and get heavy plastic, and they'll lift out those liners, and then they'll put plastic around it, trying to make it look nice or something like that. But basically, you need another level of insulation and something to help keep the moisture in there. You also need stuff to drain well in the winter, so it's kind of a tricky situation. What side of your house are these on? Are they protected?
The north-facing window, actually, two of them. And what I was going to ask you is I actually had purchased some pansies in a big plastic container that I was just going to set in the window box. Now, I understand...
In the container?
Yes.
Okay.
Plastic container inside the wrought iron box and keep them in there, and then I could just take them out, like, if it gets too cold or too much rain. It's going to probably be a pain because I'm not taking them in and out, but... What do you think about that idea?
I think you have had an excellent idea. I think you are heading in exactly the right direction. Pansies are really the only thing like that we can grow outdoors in cold weather. The line on them is that they should be planted in the soil to survive from the fall through this spring in here in the mid-Atlantic in the Northeast. But I have found that if luck is with you, which is always the case with a gardener, right, that they can survive in window boxes and in containers, especially the closer they are to the house, which kind of gives them some insulation, gives off some warmth, protects them from the harshest winds. You'll also do better, believe it or not, if you can fill up that wrought iron with multiple containers. I, you know, as you can imagine, I got a million pots at my house back on my potting bench, and I just sifted through them until I found three that fit the space and filled the space. So the less open space you have in there, the better.
Okay. And then, Mike, is there anything that you can suggest, like a trailing kind of plant that would that you could plant in there that might...
In the summertime? Sure, but not in the wintertime.
Only in the winter.
No, no. No, most window boxes get, like, left naked, stuck with plastic plants or Christmas garland or stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to grow anything over the winter here.
Yeah, that's too bad. All right, well, I appreciate this. This definitely helps.
You chose right with the pansies. Fill them up, Nance.
Yeah. Okay, Mike.
Take care.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jason, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
It's good to be on. Love the show.
Well, I thank you, Jason. It's good to have you here, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Palmville, Louisiana.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, I bought some fruit trees, a peach and a plum tree last year from Lowe's. I'm not really sure how old they are. They were about 6 foot tall. And I really don't have that much experience with growing fruit trees, but I know that my neighbor was telling me that I need to prune them this year. And I mean, I found some information about, you know, new trees, beginning trees, how to start them out, but nothing really how to prune older trees.
So I'm presuming that your trees are kind of tall, but the trunks are still pretty skinny, right?
Right, yeah, they're still pretty skinny. I'd say maybe 2 inches in diameter.
Yeah, they're still very young trees. Now, the plum trees are a little easier. Peach trees are a world of trouble, man. If this is not a case where you can just slam something into the ground and you'll be on your back porch eating peaches with your cap pulled down over your eyes. It don't work that way.
Right.
I will tell you, you will do better with both trees if you were in the future even to buy a couple more. They will produce fruit all by themselves. But if there's a couple of other peach trees around, all of the trees will do better. If there's a couple more plum trees around, all of the plums will do better. They like company.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I'd given that some thought maybe later on, but I just kind of wanted to try it and see how I'd done with them to begin with before I planted, you know, 3 or 4 more.
You did put them in the ground already, right? They're already planted.
Right, I planted them last spring. I got good, vigorous growth on a lot of new growth on the trees, and they're looking very good.
You're going to find that's a problem with the peaches. Peaches just love to grow, man. They produce so many more branches and so many more leaves than they need and is good for the peaches. That's why pruning is critically important. Now, the nice thing is you don't have to do it yet. The best fruit tree pruning is done just as winter passes into spring. The first thing you want to do is you want to look at the top of the tree and you want to take off the tallest straight up branch. This is to keep the tree from getting too tall for you to handle. You can't do this with a lot of trees, but with peaches and apples and pears, you should always be trying to take off the tallest branch to keep the tree reachable. My friend Lee Reich came up with an amazing mental image when I interviewed him on the show once. He said, when you're done pruning your tree in the spring, you should be able to pick up a cat and toss it through the branches. Now, there's something you won't forget. Right, Jace?
Right.
Yeah. Now, So you really need a lot of space between the branches, and don't worry about it, man. The thing will fill in amazingly. You'll look at it a month later and you'll go, I thought I pruned this thing. And then the hard work comes after that as the fruits begin to form. The first year, actually, if you want, you should take off all the fruits. If you absolutely insist, you can leave like 5 fruits on each tree. But that's it. You know, fruit trees are for the future. And then you'll repeat the same pruning process next late winter, early spring. And then you have to start removing 3/4 of the fruit so that there's plenty. You know, if you leave all the little fruits on the tree, all you'll get are little rotten fruits. But if you keep the base of the tree clear, clean up after every fall. Don't let any dead fruits down there. Don't let weeds grow under the tree. Make sure there's a nice mulch of compost. And do the pruning and thinning. You're going to get some good eating.
Okay.
Now, what I want you to do after we're done is go to our website. Go to You Bet Your Garden. And go to Garden Answers A to Z. And go to F under the A to Z section. And there's a short article called Fruit Trees 101. That'll give you the basics, and it'll also explain to you why you're doing what you're doing. There's a couple of other articles specific to the pruning and some suggestions for books if you want to become real good at this. But if you do the pruning and the thinning well, you have a great chance of success. All right, Jace?
All right. Thank you very much.
Eating peaches in Louisiana. It don't get no better than that, does it?
No, it don't.
All right. Good luck, sir.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll once again be honored to host the Empty Bowl Benefit Dinner for the Homeless at Chestnut Hill College on Wednesday, November 14th. And I want to urge all of you outside the Philadelphia area to seek out an Empty Bowl event near you. They're held all over the country, and they're great ways to help ensure that nobody's bowl goes empty. But don't you go search an Empty Bowl Benefit just yet, because we'll be right back with the story of an author who tried to help out with many harvests around the country, why all your impatience died this season, and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, the national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds gardeners that fall is the ideal time to plant gourmet garlic, perennial plants, bulbs for spring blooms, and especially fruit plants. More information at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Medford Lee's, a not-for-profit community serving those ages 55-plus and guided by Quaker principles, supports WHYY. This fall, there's an opportunity to explore, learn, and discover with Medford Lee's as they launch their new Pathways series. Pathways features public programming on topics covering art, politics, music, history, horticulture, and more. Full details about Medford Lee's public events, educational programming, and its campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, are online at medfordlees.org.
Bartlett Tree Expert supports WHYY and offers the removal of hazardous trees and scientific treatments including pruning and disease diagnoses. Locations in Montgomery, Chester, and Bucks counties, and Cherry Hill, New Jersey. More information at bartlett.com.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like ready-for-your-toaster Belgian waffles made in Belgium. Locations at traderjoes.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Well, if you're wondering why all your impatience died this season, I've got the news for you, and it's not good news. It's about a bad blight that wiped out my impatience and almost everyone else's as well. We'll tell you about it later in the show. We'll also have lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Richard Horan, author of the new book, Harvest, An Adventure into the Heart of America's Family Farms. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being had, Rich. You'll find out that you know there's a price to pay for being a guest on this show. Now, you are unique among our guests in that I actually took your book on vacation and read it cover to cover. I thought it would
Wonderful.
Be interesting because although I'm a gardener, the idea of these large-scale harvests has always fascinated me. I do everything on a small scale. And I know how much work it is to harvest. I'm always telling our listeners that the planting is easy, the growing is easy, but the harvesting takes a lot of time and skill. Is that one of the lessons you learned visiting all these family farms?
Oh, you got that right, especially at the end if you read about my misadventures in harvesting grapes.
Right, because you were there during a time when it was raining on and off. That happened to you during a lot of harvests, but you literally can't harvest grapes when they're really soaking wet. And I think the area you visited, the vineyards, had suffered like devastating storms where they lost a lot of their harvest right before you showed up.
That's correct. Yes. The one place, though, that I did end up in the Napa Valley was like the last vineyard there, the NV Winery. Their grapes were ready to go. Things were dry. Somehow that storm had bypassed them. But the Sonoma Valley had been completely decimated in like 2 days. Because I had no experience with it, and talking to people on the phone, they didn't even have time to talk to me. They were so much under the gun to get the grapes off the vines and to do whatever they had to do to save their harvest.
And that kind of illustrated to you how precarious this whole business is. You can have a great 90-day growing season, and you can easily lose a 10-run lead in the ninth inning. It happens to farmers all the time.
Oh, you betcha. This is not a game for the faint of heart.
Now, one of the stories that most fascinated me was your harvest of wild rice, which was still not only being harvested in the traditional style, it was being done in a respectful way by a Native American. And fishermen on the water saw you two guys and deliberately at least went so far as to help you wet yourself even if no water came in the boat, but could have swamped you and probably would not have cared. Explain the situation there and the issues between these Native Americans and this traditional crop and these sports fishermen who seem to think they own nature.
Yes, this goes back many decades to about the 60s when the up north community started getting lots of people from Chicago vacationing up there. This was right on the border between the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and the Northland of Wisconsin. So literally right on the border. The lake, Lac Vieux d'Isere, is both in Michigan and in Wisconsin. And it all has to do with the fishing rights. And the fishermen like to fish in a lake that's got lots of water in it, and they can go fast when the water levels are high. But that's not good for the wild rice. To me, the wild rice is one of the most amazing crops that exist. It's an annual, it's not a perennial. And the way that it grows in the water is just like something out of a fairy tale, how it sends the shoots up and then it goes all the way to the surface and connects down to the bottom of the water. And if there are ripples on the lake or the water's just a little bit too high, those rhizomes, they break. And then that's the end of that one stalk of rice. You know, you go through the water, I think an untrained eye would just drive right through with his or her motorboat and chop it all up. But you look around and you realize, wow, these are rice heads. They look just like wheat.
You look at wild rice, you go into a natural food supermarket or something, you look at wild rice, and I think most of us have eaten it, and we know that nutty taste, that really wild flavor. I have to say that your book has changed me in that I will never look at wild rice again. I almost felt like I should genuflect when I was in Whole Foods and actually sought out a bag of it and thought about what it takes. I know what it takes to organically farm some difficult crops. But to think of this Native American guy paddling out and my fellow Caucasians being an embarrassment to me and trying to stop this practically sacred harvest, it's like you can't tip your cap enough to people like that.
Right. It is sacrilege. And I agree. Thank you. That's a wonderful image, the genuflecting. And it is the most extraordinary crop, and just the whole religious, spiritual, cultural aspect of it just knocked my socks off. And, I did the whole thing. It's hard work, but I don't think you could spend your energies in any more appropriate pursuit in life.
one thing you learned because you worked on like 8 or 10 different farms, only for a couple of days at a time, and I can respect that. That's all I'm up for when I'm working with professionals like this,
right,
is the fact that these people don't stop. They must have boundless energy or they will be left in the road. They never seem to sleep. And I think you had the same experience I do. These are people who are working 18 times as hard as I am for 1/20th the financial reward, and they're always happy.
Isn't it great? In a world that's obsessed with jobs and money, this is the bizarro world. it's not a job. It's about work, and it's not about money. It's about culture. It's about feeling good. I don't know much about neurology, but I know that dopamine in the brain really is good for you, you know, if it comes through, you know, exercise or something that happens in an organic manner. And harvesting crops in the summer, pulling up radishes and carrots and potatoes, I tell you, the dopamine flows.
We're talking to Richard Horan, author of the new book, Harvest, An Adventure into the Heart of America's Family Farms, where Richard went and participated in the harvest on a number of different American farms. You wound up at a famous place, and that is the legendary Wood Prairie Farm. And
Jim Gerritsen, yes.
And, you know, not only is this man a tireless worker who produces some of the most amazing heirloom potatoes in America, you know, completely organically, but he is a righteous leader in not only the organic movement, trying to keep it organic only, but trying to fight these biologically engineered crops.
That's correct. He's a leader, and I hope that his voice gets out there to more and more people. They know him. The slow food people know about him. The slow money people know about him. The Occupy Wall Street people know about him. And now, best of all, the Monsanto people know about Jim Gerritsen.
But I tell you, anybody who's grown potatoes in an organic raised bed garden kind of knows about him, because it's almost synonymous with high-quality, organic, certified, virus-free seed potatoes. Wood Prairie Farms comes immediately to mind, and I have
right.
to congratulate you. You did teach me something. I'd been meaning to actually call him and get him on the show, because I was wondering and I was concerned. I know he's up in Maine. I know the soil sucks. There is no soil. It's all rocks. And he's
it's been, all rocks.
And he's been growing potatoes for years and years, decades and decades. And I was thinking, you know, potatoes are such a disease-prone crop. It almost seems impossible to follow potatoes with potatoes and not create your own kind of disaster, your new potato famine. But you described an intricate 4-year rotation that I just thought was beyond brilliant.
Yes, and he's very glib about it. He explains it to you. If you ask him again, he'll explain it again. And it sounds like a system that's been working for him for quite some time.
But the bottom line is he only grows potatoes in a piece of land every 4th year. And between that are all these crops that are grown to grow something different or to nourish the soil.
That's correct. Yeah, green manure, I think, is the phrase he likes to use. Throwing down legumes and some of these other types of crops to get the nutrients back in the soil.
And I can tell you from just my research background and my gardening background that he's kind of going overboard in the best possible way. I mean, a 3-year rotation would be perfectly safe for him to do 4 years. It's just like, you know, I've always felt that organic was the new gourmet, but he's kind of redefining it. This is like, you know, you want to put his potatoes up on a pedestal now.
Well, I do. Yes, he's got the system, and he's about as pure an organic farmer as you can meet. And he's very serious about it. He loves the work. He's got his family behind him who works right alongside him, and they're being groomed. They look like they're just going to jump right in.
And thank God, because that is so rarely the case on any kind of farm these days.
Oh, sure.
All right. Richard Horan is the author of Harvest, An Adventure into the Heart of America's Family Farms, where he went and participated in the harvest at 10 different farms. It's a fascinating book. We recommend it highly. It'll teach you a lot about Richard. It'll teach you a lot about harvesting, teach you a lot about the state of American agriculture. And it's a brand new book from Harper Perennial. Richard Horan, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls. And 1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good, Carol. How are you?
I'm all right.
And where is Carol all right?
Well, I live in a little town called Riverdale in Delaware.
Oh, okay. Where is Riverdale?
West of the ocean, outside of Rehoboth.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, obviously, everybody in our area knows Rehoboth Beach. That's a beautiful area. You sound like you're surrounded by water everywhere.
Yes, that's the truth. And we've got some marshland out in back of us that has come overrun with the Phragmites plant.
Oh, man, that is a monster.
I know.
One of the things I'm going to refer you to, if that's the topic that you want to discuss, is when we're done, I want you to go to our website. So all you have to do is go to youbetyourgarden.org, click on Garden Answers A to Z, and then go to P for Phragmites. And that'll clue you in to what your options are, how people are dealing with it.
The problem here is that we put strawberry bed, it's a few feet from where the Phragmites start.
But
what they have done is they go underneath the ground of the strawberry bed and pop up in the bed.
Oh, yeah. No, they're going to, and they're probably going to continue to invade your territory. How long have you lived in this home?
We've been there for about 6 years now.
So you've watched these creatures advancing on you.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have.
Were there any Phragmites? These are giant. How would you describe them? I mean, to me, they're like giant ornamental grasses of some kind.
They are. They look like a baygrass or a bamboo plant or something of that nature, although thinner than a bamboo. You can snap them, you know, but they do not go away. They just keep coming and coming.
Yes, and they are they're pushing a lot of other plants out of the way. Now, I will tell you that the University of Delaware, and
okay,
I believe it was at the Newark campus, is the leading edge of research on Phragmites. So you should be in touch with them. I mean, if Phragmites is on your property, they want to know about it. They want to help you fend it off, and they may even be able to give you some assistance. Because, again, as you've noticed, this plant is just going to keep advancing onto your property, because the way you described your property, obviously you're surrounded by water. I imagine everything is pretty wet most of the time.
Oh, yeah.
And that's going to allow them, they're not going to stop. So my uneducated answer is, because you even use the word bamboo, that they're bamboo-like in their growth pattern, you need to install something, I would think, called rhizome barrier, which is an underground barrier that will at least keep them on the other side and stop the advancement.
Is this rhizome barrier a natural, like, deterrent?
Oh, it's both natural and unnatural. It's actually a physical barrier that's put underground. When people plant things that have, whose roots are going to wander, like running bamboo, and these people are good neighbors, they have it planted inside a rhizome barrier.
I see.
If you go to any American bamboo website, for instance, there'll be people who sell it and install it, and there'll be descriptions of it. But that would at least stop the advance. And then there are a number of tricks that the people at the University of Delaware are doing to knock it back. There's certain times of year it can be attacked, and they have water-loving plants that they can use to replace it, because obviously you can't just rip them all out or they'll grow back. But there are some plants that grow just as well as them that are less aggressive that can be used to block their spread. So you need to be working with the University of Delaware. You really need to get a barrier installed to stop the advancement on your property. And I would suggest while they're dormant, you get your strawberries out of that bed, move them back closer to the house, move them out of that area. And maybe consider, you know, that part of your land is you know, it's got to be pretty wet. So I presume you're growing in raised beds or something?
Yes.
You're going to have to put a barrier in before you consider that that is really yours to grow in. There's really no easy solution. This is a very powerful plant with a very aggressive root system, and as long as there's moisture in the soil, it's going to come advancing towards you. You got to stop that Phragmites. It will. How far is it from your house?
Well, it's probably roughly 8 feet, 9 feet
from your house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got to stop it now.
Okay.
You know, the burglar is at the back door banging on it.
Okay.
All right, good luck. This is a monster plant, and you need to get on top of it.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, Carol. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and ask listeners on Facebook to go to our page and cast a vote. We caught a little flack recently from a Facebook friend after pointing out that evil squirrels are, well, evil. Our friend disagrees with our insightful observation, and so we're going to leave the decision up to you. Please visit the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page and cast your vote at our special ballot box. Squirrels, threat, or menace? The choice is yours. But don't go engaging in democracy at its finest just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and really bad news about impatience. I'm Bad News Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, the national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds gardeners that fall is the ideal time to plant gourmet garlic, perennial plants, bulbs for spring blooms, and especially fruit plants. More information at burpee.com.
It's 11:38. This is WHYY.
Longwood Gardens supports WHYY. Longwood Gardens and the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society present a lecture and book signing with international landscape architect Kim Wilkie on October 29th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Wilkie's the author of a new book, Led by the Land, where he discusses landscape, sustainability, regeneration, and design. Wilkie's also the designer of Longwood Gardens' East Conservatory Plaza, home to the largest green wall in North America. Tickets and details at longwoodgardens.org.
WHYY is supported by Works for Me, funded by CMS grant CFDA number 93.768. Works for Me offers hiring tips, training, and help finding employees. Details at worksforme-pa.org/employer.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series supports WHYY and is presented by Widener University, continuing its sold-out season at the Kimmel Center on October 29th with New York Times best-selling author of The Glass Castle, Jeanette Walls. Sponsored by WHYY and BNY Mellon Wealth Management.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll explain why so many beds of impatiens died this past summer and why there may not be even any impatiens to buy next year. It's a bad story about a bad blight, and we'll tell you all the details after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Mike.
I have some trees that have dropped all their leaves probably about a month ago. And I have some other trees. I live on an acreage, so I have thousands of trees. I have some other trees that have dropped probably half their leaves. The last 2 years have been really brutal. 2011, we had about 63 days above 100. And last year we had about 34 days above 100. I don't know if it's because of the heat. Every year I do lose some trees. My question is, if it does, in the middle of summer, lose all of its leaves, is the tree dead?
And where are we here, Mike?
We're just east of Edmond, about 50 miles northeast of Oklahoma City in Oklahoma.
Okay, so you have had record just broiling heat waves.
Oh, it's been brutal, yeah.
Now, what are you going to do different based on my answer? Are you worried about the trees becoming unstable and falling down?
No, actually, if they're dead, I'm going to go ahead and cut them into firewood and use the firewood.
Well, the answer is a little bit complex. If we have a really hot summer or other stresses occur, sometimes trees, deciduous trees, will drop their leaves early. But the question becomes, how much time did they have early in the game? In other words, if a tree flushes out perfectly, the young leaves are fully colored, they appear healthy, and they're sitting out there, and they're having their day at the beach for, let's say, 2 months. And then something happens, and the tree decides that to save itself, it's time to drop these leaves and start sealing up, which is can be a reaction to cold or a reaction to extreme heat. It's always possible, if enough time has passed, that the tree has collected all of the solar energy it needs. Photosynthesis is the most effective and efficient early in the season. These young leaves coming out, you know, it's like when we were younger, we were much more energetic and efficient. Remember that, Mike?
I do remember that.
And these young leaves really soak it up, and they really process those sugars and carbohydrates. As a leaf ages throughout its lifetime of a single season, it gradually loses that ability. So by the time here in the Northeast, for instance, that our leaves start to change color, they really haven't been doing much for the month previous to that. So okay. I would say it is not a certain sign, but if you have similar trees, one tree dropped its leaves and the other tree kept its leaves, and you need to cull, let's say, three trees for your wood-burning needs for the winter, it would be correct to take the one of the two that dropped its leaves early, because that tree showed you that it was under stress. Now, if left alone and you have a normal season, which you've probably never experienced in your entire life in Oklahoma, the tree could be fine.
And if it doesn't come back the second year...
Oh, if it doesn't leaf out in the spring, I would have it sideways on the ground by June.
Okay, okay.
Because when you have that kind of weather brutality and a tree drops its leaves, that's a natural instinct. It's like a cool season lawn going brown. Everybody freaks out. They think the lawn is dying, but actually the lawn is doing everything it can to stay alive. And the key is, if nobody helps, if humans don't go in and try to help, the natural instincts of the plant will often trump the weather. But this is a natural instinct of plants under great stress. If they have absorbed enough energy to get them through the winter, it's perfectly appropriate and almost in a weird way intelligent of them to drop their leaves a little early. All right, okay. Good luck, Mike. I hope your winter is better than your summer.
Last year was great. Thank you so much. I love your show.
Well, thanks. We love being on down there. Take care.
Uh-huh. You too.
1-888-346-9499. Arnett, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Arnett. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am very well. Thank you. Where are you?
I'm in Cape May, New Jersey.
Okay, down by the shore.
Down by the beach.
Right by the Atlantic Ocean, a great place to be in the summer. What can we do for our net near the ocean?
We have a garden around the perimeter of our house, and it was filled with chickweed. I have meticulously on my hands and knees pulled out the chickweed as best I can. The garden looks pretty clean right now, and I'm wondering what I do next to reduce the chickweed from coming back.
Well, chickweed is a strange little weed. First of all, you'll never be done with it, Arnett.
No.
It's like being done with air. You know, chickweed is one of the most common garden weeds that we have. I mean, if you want to be technical about it, it is a sign of overwatering as opposed to underwatering. It's a sign of fertile soil. But it's also ubiquitous. It's just everywhere. It's a very happy little plant. As you know, it's not really that bothersome. It's very easy to pull. It just has a lot of children. It's a very big family once they move in to a garden bed. And you'll never eradicate it, but you can hold it back quite a bit. You're down the shore, which is always an interesting situation. Will you have access, or do you have access currently to fall leaves coming down?
I do. There are some trees in our neighbor's yard that hang over our side of the property, and there are some leaves that fall in right in the garden, actually.
Right. Well, you want to be careful. I do not advise letting whole leaves lay on garden beds. Because they mat down like a tarp. They can get moldy underneath. They prevent the transfer of air and water. And they're really not good for, like, the crowns of your hostas or the roots of any perennials that you have in those beds.
Okay. I do have a lot of daffodils and tulips in the beds.
So what I advise you to do, if you have one already, great. If not, it's a great investment. Get a leaf blower that has a reverse setting and a collection bag. And just suck the leaves up off your garden beds and all the other places in your yard while you stand up. And then you have two choices. If you really want to nail the chickweed, I would empty the bags on the beds right away. Just take all these shredded leaves, and instead of taking them someplace else, just unzip the bag, spread them on top of the bed, and then use a rake or something to level them out to, you know, no deeper than 2 inches.
And okay.
If you have a 2-inch deep mulch of shredded leaves on top of your bed, that is a great weed suppressor. Now, what I suggest you do when the soil starts to warm up in the spring is gently rake away those leaves, especially if they didn't get shredded up very well, and just hold them to the side. Allow the shoots of your spring bulbs to come up and the other, you know, perennials to show their above ground growth, but then get those leaves right back on the beds and use those as a mulch and a weed suppressor and to keep moisture in the soil. Now, with lawns, we have found out that a fall feeding with corn gluten meal prevents chickweed because it's what's called a winter annual. It sprouts at the end of summer and grows well over winter. You may have germinating chickweed in your beds right now, unless you just recently pulled it out.
I did just recently pull it out, and as I was pulling it out, I would rake over the soil and kind of smooth it out, and a lot of times it just seemed like I was getting as much as I could of the chickweed, but every once in a while I'd find, like, okay, I missed that spot, and there's a whole big chunk of chickweed there.
Yes, and when you do that, when you disturb the soil, you expose more seeds.
Yeah,
so you'll get more.
Scattering those seeds around, right?
Between that little corn gluten in the fall and the breakdown of the leaves, don't feed your plants anything else. That's exactly all the nutrients they would ever want.
Sounds great. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. The bad blight that is wiping out impatiens. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read this week's disturbing questions.
All right, Mike. Well, we heard from Jack in the Germantown section of Philadelphia, who writes, I planted 3 flats of impatiens throughout my yard, by themselves and in mixed displays in the backyard, in the front yard, in beds and pots, in deep shade, partial shade, and even some in semi-full sun. They were fed naturally, no chemical fertilizer, and watered. And they all lost their leaves and died. I have been advised by a grower that there has been a widespread problem with downy mildew this year. What do you think? We also heard from Danny in Reading, Pennsylvania, who writes, "My impatiens started out really nice, then began disappearing little by little. Flowers first, then leaves, then stems. I looked for bugs but could see none. What's up?"
Well, what's up is something that would have been headline news all summer if it had attacked a food crop like tomatoes or sweet corn. But because it instead went after an ornamental annual flower, and only one type of that ornamental annual flower, it flew under a lot of people's radar, including mine. Only after a farmer friend asked why I hadn't mentioned it did I start making calls. And what I discovered was astonishing. Although the impatiens family is huge, around 850 species in the genus, there are basically only 2 members commonly used as bedding plants, explained Marge Daughtry, a senior extension associate in the Department of Plant Pathology at Cornell University's Long Island Research Center. The common, shade-loving bedding plant we all know, and the taller, more sun-tolerant New Guinea hybrids. The former, the ones everybody just calls impatiens, are toast, virtually wiped out over a single season by a specific downy mildew. New Guinea impatiens are so far totally unaffected by this disease. Affected only ever so slightly is our own Native American member of the family, which you know is jewelweed. Yes, the legendary and pretty weed that is so ubiquitous across the nation is a member of the impatiens family. Jewelweed just gets a little spotting on its leaves, so little you wouldn't notice it unless you looked real close. But there's nothing slight about the effect of this mildew on the common bedding plant. It strikes fast, explains Cornell's Daughtry. First, the flowers seem to vanish, then the leaves disappear, leaving only stems. A visual that reminded me of typical slug damage so much, I assumed the Slimers had visited my little patch. Yes, my impatiens were hit this summer as well. Apparently, few gardens were spared. Now, it turns out, weirdly enough, that the disease what done this is nothing new. Cornell's Daughtry explains that it was first identified in the United States on jewelweed in the 1800s and has just kind of been hanging around ever since. It's one of many pathogens grouped under the common term downy mildew, a designation so broad it includes multiple plant families as well as individual species. All, she explains, are water molds, primitive swimming spores that can multiply rapidly in wet situations. This one, now termed impatiens downy mildew, or IDM for short, wiped out small groups of impatiens in England in 2003, explains Daughtry. Then it appeared in a Long Island greenhouse in 2004. Then it only accounted for a couple reported cases a year until 2009, when it wiped out most of the impatiens plantings in Saratoga Springs, New York. Then, she continues, it hit parts of New York State real bad last fall. But it was so late in the season that most gardeners assumed it was just frost damage. Impatiens are real drama queens about cold weather, and they're typically the first plants to join the choir invisible when light frosts are even mentioned. Then this year, it hit hard, and it hit almost everywhere except the Dakotas and Montana, and it hit early. Daughtry found it on plants on June 4th on Long Island. That's barely 2 weeks after safe planting out time. When asked what we can do about this situation, Daughtry simply said, "Say bye-bye to impatiens next season." Fungicides are not very effective against this downy mildew. And even if they were, you'd have to be spraying the plants every week. And the spores are everywhere. There may not be very many impatiens even for sale next season, she adds. Growers are still talking about what to do. But nobody wants to sell plants that are just going to shrivel up and die before the 4th of July. And the smart move would be to just take them out of cultivation for a couple of years and see if things settle down. There's lots of nice bedding plant alternatives. New Guinea impatiens, annual begonias, coleus, and terrinia, the wishbone plant, an underused and very attractive shade-loving annual. If regular impatiens are available next season, at the very least, don't plant them in the same spot where this year's plants dropped all those spores. And if you do choose to plant impatiens and they start to disappear, just leave them be. You would just poison yourself in a futile attempt to save them. Terrinia sounds better by the minute. Well, that sure was a swift kick in the pants to all the shady gardeners out there, now wasn't it? For those who wish to more carefully peruse all the depressing details, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over at your leisure, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to take me out of cultivation if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse team, because our garden is short, at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Like us on Facebook. Put the actual subject in the subject line. Like us on Facebook. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems just like yours in our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and like us on Facebook already. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Jaunty John Knapp. Our illustrious internet-eye are Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar. Check out their fine work at our newly designed website. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, reminds us that no photo ID is required to cast your vote at our Facebook page. What are we voting on? Squirrels, threat, or menace? Non-menacing, Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Voting early and often are our production assistants, Joanna Hatzis and Brett Rader. Always a threat is our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'm Squirrely Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. The right tree can provide food, shade, and beauty. The wrong tree can destroy your driveway. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll play Good Tree, Bad Tree, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike's mission is to make marvelous mulch, mulberry, mayflowers, mint, or mistletoe for a magnificent garden. Make it a date, Saturday mornings at 11 for You Bet Your Garden, here on WHYY.